From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
The celebrated, historic, and necessary Voting Rights Act of 1965 suffered a very serious blow.
A historic week in the Supreme Court. What does it mean for Latino voters and equal access? And the headlines declared an end to unpaid internships as Warner Music, Condé Nast, and Gawker face lawsuits by former interns. Here's our take with Farai Chidea.
There's not always a linkage between unpaid internships, the future of the economy, and race and class.
Then to Florida and a look at the Ferrari of bilingual education programs, dual language immersion. And it's not just for Latinos anymore.
I constantly see my dad struggling to convey across his thought to Spanish vendors, barbers, neighbors.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Well, it's been an eventful week for the Supreme Court. The Defense of Marriage Act was ruled unconstitutional, a huge victory for gay rights activists. But Latinos and other people of color also felt an enormous blow when the court blocked an important part of the Voting Rights Act. Here to talk about some of these cases and their impact on Latinos and people of color is Mirna Perez. She's deputy director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University and a frequent guest on Latino USA. Welcome back, Mirna.
Thank you so much for having me, Maria.
So first off, we've had two decisions come in related to voting. One case deals with voter registration and the other with states' rights to change local voting laws and procedures. Give us the synopsis of the two separate cases that were decided on.
Sure. The case that got decided on Tuesday, it was a very, very sad day for our democracy. We have an important and necessary federal protection, making sure that we are able to vote without discrimination in our elections. And that is called the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, and it is a celebrated and historic act that makes good on the promise that our Constitution gives us of being able to vote without discrimination. But one important thing that it did was it found those jurisdictions which have the most egregious history of discriminating against people of color and imposed certain rules on them.
Basically, you're talking about oversight over states that had a history of racial discrimination in the South.
Right. That provision is called preclearance. It's established through Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court did not strike down Section 5, and that's really important to remember. But what it did do was strike down another provision that said where Section 5 was going to apply. And because of that, the voters in those jurisdictions that have a demonstrated history of racial discrimination are without this important federal protection.
All right. So in terms of the Arizona case that came up in terms of the requirement to proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, what happened on that case?
That case was a victory for the civil rights community. Arizona's proof of citizenship law allowed the Arizona officials to reject federal registration forms if they did not submit documentary proof of citizenship with that registration.
So how does that apply in real life?
Imagine you're being asked to register to vote at a grocery store. Someone hands you a form. You would also have to have a copy of your birth certificate, your naturalization papers, and would have to submit it with that form. And a lot of voters didn't do that. And so they were rejected by Arizona. The Supreme Court said that states need to use and accept the federal form.
So let's talk about how these cases specifically affect Latino voters and other people of color. And let's start with the decision on the Voting Rights Act, which was, of course, a centerpiece of the civil rights movement. So maybe there are some Latinos who are saying, well, I don't live in the South. I'm not sure. I don't feel like I've been a victim of discrimination in terms of voting. How does this apply to me?
Well, a number of jurisdictions that have high Latino populations were formally covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. We have Texas, we have California. And what's really important to remember is that Section 5 stopped voter discrimination. So if you did not feel like you were being discriminated against and you live in a covered jurisdiction, it was probably because Section 5 was doing its job.
So what's your concern about what happens now? I mean, the Attorney General of the state of Texas immediately started saying, well, we're moving forward with our requirements to make it essentially more challenging to register to vote.
One would be that jurisdictions, states or localities would be trying to revive changes that had gotten blocked before. Now we're afraid they're going to start it over again. We're worried about those changes that people were holding back because they were hoping that there wasn't going to be a Voting Rights Act. The other thing that we haven't discussed, which is really important to remember, are those changes that could be harmful to minority voters that aren't legislation. What if they cancel an election because they're worried that a minority community might win them, which has happened in Mississippi? Those kinds of changes happen without public notice and outside public scrutiny. And those are going to be very, very hard to catch and stop before they're actually able to injure voters.
Mina, we spoke about a case on Latino USA a couple of weeks ago, the Fisher versus UT Austin case. We're switching gears now. That took up basically affirmative action. And it seemed that the court's decision this Monday was generally favorable towards the university's race-based policy. Right?
Most commentators say that it did a couple of really important things. It upheld the idea of an affirmative action policy. It said that they were permissible. It also affirmed the importance of diversity and that diversity is a compelling consideration that universities can look at when they're trying to decide who they should admit and who they shouldn't admit.
That's Mina Perez. She's deputy director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law and a frequent commentator on Latino USA. Thanks again, Mina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now it's time for News or Noise, where we get behind the hype and do a little bit of news literacy. This time we're talking about unpaid internships. Joining us now is Farai Chidea. She's a journalist and distinguished writer-in-residence at NYU and a well-known personality on NPR and on TV. Hello, Farai.
It's so great to see you, Maria.
As well. And also joining us is Hannah Guerrero. She's our current intern at Latino USA, and she's my former student at DePaul University in Chicago. And for the record, she does receive a stipend for her work. So welcome to Latino USA, Hannah.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so we're going to start out with you, putting the intern on the spot here. You've been watching what's been happening with the coverage. So what is the conversation? What is the story about what's happened with unpaid interns?
Well, there have been a number of lawsuits in the news lately concerning the legitimacy of unpaid internships. The one that's making waves in the news lately is the interns that were on the set of the film Black Swan. The judge ruled that they should have been paid because essentially they were doing the same work as paid employees.
Right. There were a couple of other lawsuits also against New Yorker magazine, W Magazine, and Warner Music Group. So, Farai, as a journalist, when you look at the coverage, we'll talk about the story in a minute, but the coverage, what was news and what was noise in the conversation?
Well, you know, I think that the issue of unpaid internships is definitely news. The noise comes from, it's in some ways an absence because there's not always a linkage between unpaid internships, the future of the economy, and race and class. But what we've seen are, you know, overview analytical pieces on the trials or on the lawsuits, rather. But really what we have to do is contextualize this in, you know, looking not just at the future of millennials, but there's people who are older who take unpaid internships to try to reboot their careers. There's a devastating unemployment differential between the white population and between Blacks and Latinos in particular. And all of this plays into, can you afford to take an unpaid internship to either start or reboot your career? Let me go back to one thing about coverage. One aspect of coverage that I find really interesting is the ProPublica series. They're doing like an intern investigation. And on Twitter, you can see the hashtag Project Intern. And so I think one of the things I really admire about how they're approaching it is that they're doing an all call, asking interns to describe their experiences. So they're still rolling content out. But I like the interactivity of that as a media form.
So what is the conversation that is not being covered in the news media around the importance of class and race, specifically around internships in the news media? Was it covered or was it not covered, Farai?
Well, in a piece I did for The Nation, I talked about it. But, you know, it's not that all Blacks and Latinos can't afford unpaid internships, but statistically speaking, there's a much smaller group who can. And there's also a privilege economy that goes on where people hire their kids, their friends' kids, their coworkers' kids. And so by the time you blend the unpaid nature of the internship with the privilege economy, where people are just one person, and I won't reveal, you know, what company, but someone in publishing told me that the CEO of the publishing house places all the interns, and it's all on a favoritism basis of, like, I need to get my friend's kids an internship.
Does the media get the fact that if we don't have class and racial diversity in the pool of people who can afford to do an internship, and hopefully a paid one, that if we don't have that, then all of us end up suffering because of the media that's being produced by essentially a not a very diverse group of journalists?
Well, you know, I did a previous piece for the Columbia Journalism Review, and someone who's a newsroom supervisor in New York pushed back and said, well, essentially, you can get diverse journalism without a diverse staff, and gave the example of his staff covering Hurricane Sandy. And I addressed that in the piece I later did, because that's not always the case. I mean, for some things, yes, but if you really want to understand America, you better have a diverse staff, because we're just people, we reporters, we know people based on our life experience. And so if you don't have a diverse newsroom with different types of connections, you get a very narrow view of the story.
Hannah, we spoke to a friend of yours. Her name is Rita Das. She's graduating in August from the University of Illinois in Chicago, and she told us about her experiences as an intern.
I have had two unpaid internships. I did get another internship last summer, which was unpaid, but in that sense, they made me pay for college credit, and I couldn't take it just because I'm not going to pay to work for someone who should be paying me.
Wow. So because people forget that if it's a college credit, you're actually paying for that.
Yeah,
so your friend was like, so I have to pay for the college credit and I have to go work for you for free. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And that happens all the time for college students in the summer, especially, because if you want to take an unpaid internship, they will demand that you have to receive college credit. And in order to do that, you need to take an internship course through your university, and you have to pay for that class. Some of us just can't afford to do that.
So, Hannah, as a journalism student and as an intern, what was missing for you in terms of the coverage? What was news and what was noise?
What I was looking for in the news was more from a student's point of view and a journalism student, also speaking about what Farai's been talking about the lack of diversity in the media, and how in order to have more voices in the media, we need to allow students, especially that may not have the opportunity to take an unpaid internship, to have the opportunity to take one.
Well, on that note, thanks for joining us, Hannah. And Farai, thanks as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Farai Chidea is a journalist and distinguished writer in residence at New York University. And Latino USA's intern is Hannah Guerrero, who is paid a stipend for her work and is a student at DePaul University in Chicago. So if you have something on your mind where you want us to get behind the hype, just let us know. Send us a tweet at Latino USA, all one word, and tell us about an issue you think is news or noise. Coming up on Latino USA, it takes a village to teach a child in two languages at once, but you gotta believe in the program. Tienes que creerlo.
Everybody who teaches here, from the custodians, from the people in the cafeteria, from the teachers, the faculty, the staff, everybody who has something to do with our school has to believe in the program. We all have to be on the same page.
The country's first bilingual education program still going strong in Miami, Florida. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Pasar un cometa. Cuando me besa confiada en los labios me deja un sabor a menta que perdura hasta la mañana. Como lo hace su mirada. Yo daría lo que no y lo que tengo por tenerte junto a mí cada momento.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It's been 50 years since the nation's first bilingual education program started at Coral Way Elementary School in Miami. It was supposed to be a temporary program to help Cuban students retain their language and culture while their families waited for the Castro regime to fall. Of course, that didn't happen. And today, even though bilingual education often gets entangled with the controversy over immigration, Coral Way is still going strong. Trina Sargalski has our story.
Genesis Venegas Calvo is a fifth grader at Coral Way. She arrived in first grade.
I basically only knew how to say hello in English. That's all I knew.
For Genesis, knowing two languages is kind of like having two roads available to get to a destination.
For example, there are some things that you can't quite grasp in English or some things you can't quite grasp in Spanish. So that's why I love the bilingual program, because whatever you don't understand in English, they can teach it to you in Spanish and vice versa.
Coral Way follows a specific model of bilingual education called dual immersion. Regardless of whether students speak English or Spanish as a first language, they're all spending about half their time learning in both. Coral Way is widely recognized as a model of successful dual language immersion. The school regularly gets an A for its scores on Florida's standardized tests. Robert Linquanti is a researcher in Oakland, California, who's studied bilingual education in public schools for almost 25 years. Linquanti says the dual immersion system at Coral Way is a Ferrari model.
It's considered the most powerful model of bilingual education.
But he says that success isn't determined by what languages are taught or when they're taught.
It's not about the language of instruction. It's about the quality of instruction.
Linquanti says that for a bilingual school program to thrive, you've got to have excellent teachers. Teachers who are strong in the language they're teaching in, as well as in the subject matter. And teachers who believe in the mission of the school.
A ver, dime, Álvaro.
Trata de que el sol, que ya es popular la tierra, entonces envía su...
Ya, poblar
la tierra, entonces...
Cristina Vasquez is a case in point.
¿Alguien podrá leer ese problema en español? En español.
She went to Coral Way as a student and has taught here for 17 years.
Everybody who teaches here, from the custodians, from the people in the cafeteria, from the teachers, the faculty, the staff, everybody who has something to do with our school has to believe in the program. We all have to be on the same page.
When the bilingual program started in 1963, many of the Cuban students were actually in Miami alone. Their parents were afraid that the communist government was going to indoctrinate their kids, so they sent them to the U.S. There were many Greek and Jewish families in the Coral Way neighborhood who took the kids in. Many of those families thought it would be a good idea for their own children to learn a second or third language at Coral Way. Third grader Theo Miller finds it useful.
My dad, you know, he could say, like, hola, ¿cómo estás? But he, like, doesn't, you know, speak, like, hola, ¿cómo estás?
So Theo helps him navigate.
I constantly see my dad struggling to convey across his thought to Spanish vendors, barbers, neighbors. Sometimes he'll grab me by the shoulders, put me in front of him. Mi translator niño.
People might joke about Spanish being the first language of Miami, but one reason for the success of Coral Way's bilingual program is that in Miami, Spanish has status. The first Cuban exiles in the 60s were mostly the elites from cosmopolitan Havana. They established their economic and political power in Miami, which still prevails. Today, as the city welcomes a wider array of Latin American immigrants, speaking Spanish might be even more important than before. At Coral Way, being bilingual doesn't seem to be a big deal to many of the students. It's just natural. After school, some fifth graders show just how seamless this blend is. They're rehearsing an old English classic, Robin Hood, for a Spanish theater festival.
Estoy enamorada, pero nena! ¿Y quién es el afortunado? Ay, es tan guapo, tan alto, tan listo. ¿Pero quién es? ¿Justin Bieber?
No, Robin and Oxley.
Ah, pues no es para tanto.
¡Viva!
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 For Latino USA, this is Trina Sargalski.
And now time for something we call a bocadito, a little morsel of news. A decade ago, here's what it sounded like on the small Puerto Rican island of Vieques. People chanting, Navy, get out! they were demonstrating against the fact that the U.S. Navy had used Vieques as a practice bombing range for more than 50 years. One of the leading protesters was popular salsero singer Danny Rivera.
We wanted the Marine just go out of Puerto Rico, of Vieques, Puerto Rico, and give us a chance to live in peace and give to the next generations of young people a good place to live.
The Navy did pull out of Vieques 10 years ago in May of 2003, leaving behind unexploded bombs on the land and in the sea. Viequenses have unusually high cancer rates, which they say are caused by environmental toxins left by the bombing. Today, a decade later, artists from Puerto Rico and the U.S. are coming together to raise money for a new community radio station called Radio Vieques. 15 groups, including Calle 13, Los Lonely Boys, and Willie Nelson, have donated their music to make a downloadable album called Artists for Vieques. Here's Puerto Rican artist Miriam Perez with the song Risueño Eden, Smiling Paradise. Supporters say Radio Vieques will be an important source of information as the island navigates its future. The station plans to start transmission on June 30th. Find out more about Artists for Vieques at our website, latinousa.org. Now, if you're a regular listener to Latino USA, then you may have heard this voice more than once.
Beltran's dark-weathered face reflects years of life outdoors.
That's the voice of our producer, Andres Caballero. This is his last show with Latino USA. Through ups and downs, he's always come through, no matter what madness was handed to him, always with the serene, no se preocupe, jefa. And so we are very excited for Andres Caballero's new adventures abroad, but sorry he won't be part of our new adventures here as our program moves to the one-hour format. Andres has always been our biggest soñador. He was our Che. So, muchas gracias, y ya sabes, aquí está tu casa siempre. And for this week, that's Latino USA. Please become our amigos. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Tumblr. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Lita Hartman, AC Valdez, Andres Caballero, Daisy Rosario, Diana Montaño, Miguel Simon Jonsson, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. News or Noise is funded by the Why News Matters initiative at the McCormick Foundation, fostering communities of educated, informed, and engaged citizens. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Annie E. Casey Foundation with Kids Count, national, state, and local data on the well-being of kids at datacenter.kidscount.org, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR.